Welcome to Searching for the Question Live. My name is David Orban, and I am very happy to welcome back today a guest who's already been on the show maybe a couple of years ago to talk about AI safety from also a very practical point of view. What does it mean to design, train, align, and then deploy advanced large language models that are doing what we want them to do and that don't do what we don't them what we don't want them to do? Francesco Mosconi is an AI expert. He has been in the field of data science for a long time. And now he is in the thick of the themes that I just mentioned, that I'm sure that our conversation is going to be very, very interesting. I am definitely looking forward to it. Welcome, Francesco, to Searching for the Question Live.
Hi, David. Hello, everyone. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So let's start from kind of the beginning. We have been designing ever bigger systems, large language models, based on the transformer algorithm. Recently, we have been extending this so that the models are multimodal. Yeah. They not only generate text, but they are able to generate images, video, and many other things.
And understand text and understand video and understand.
That's right. Images. Take it not only
both input and output.
Input and output. Thank you. And we have been doing all of this without really understanding them. Is that correct, or is that an exaggeration?
I think it's becoming more and more of an exaggeration, as in we're starting to understand them better and better. The company I work at has done research. It's called Anthropic, and has done research in the space, but we're not the only one. The theme of understanding what's going on, opening the black box and understanding what's going on inside the box is a very, very well-researched and cutting-edge as well topic, that of interpretability. Yeah. And so we still don't understand many aspects of them, but we understand more and more of them. And the hope is we will understand them fully at some point.
Concretely, these large language models are a very, very large number of numbers. Mm-hmm. These are the weights of the model after training, where the weights reflect and encode the training that has data been received, the training data that is being encoded in these numbers, and then presented with the input. The input flows through the model and generates the output in a very, very superficial way. Nothing more is happening.
No.
And it is one of the reasons why, given how surprisingly effective these have been, people like Andre Karpathy is talking about software 2.0, where a lot of the functionality that used to be hand-coded and was the core of what software engineering was about now is disappearing because it is being sucked into this system that is able to do a lot of things by its own.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing is how this system organizes knowledge internally. For me, the thing that clicked in my mind made me understand, wow, this is actually super interesting and different from what I've seen so far, was a paper that came out maybe 5-6 years ago. It's called The Sentiment Neuron and was published by OpenAI back then. What the researchers did using the models of the time, which were orders of magnitude simpler than the models we're dealing with now, they took a training set of reviews, product reviews from Amazon. Now, product reviews, by nature, they are positive and negative. So somewhere in the data set, there is a concept of sentiment, meaning positive or negative sentiment about the product. And what they did, they trained a small model to predict the next character, not the next word like we do now, not the next token, but it was a very simple model that given 50 characters of a review, it tried to predict the next letter. Exactly. So the interesting finding of this paper is that somewhere in the deep layers of the network had learned the concept that we call sentiment. In other words, to be effective at the given goal, which was predict what the next character is going to be, the network had to abstract away from just the characters and learn the concept of sentiment, because the concept of sentiment turned out to be useful to predict the next character. And you can see that if you stop here, you can see that these colors, let me explain what we're looking at. There is a piece of text, and it's a review of a movie, of a book. It starts pretty positive, and then it becomes negative. It starts saying the character, et cetera, beautifully developed, et cetera, but then it becomes negative, and the color represents what that specific neuron understands, and it's positive in the green and negative in the red. So a concept that was latent, meaning it was present in the data but not explicitly explained to the network, turned out to be learned by the network in order to achieve the task of predicting the next character. And what we're seeing today is an extension of this. A large network that's tasked to predict what's going to happen next is learning features that are useful to do that prediction. And if the data that's used to train the network is wide enough, the network will learn complex features that map well to our concepts.
I saw a similar example developed by one of the teams led by Max Tegmark at MIT, where the neurons that were identified and mapped represented the geographical distribution of the continents.
Exactly. That's another example of
where this emerging understanding was correlated to geographical data.
Yep.
So these two examples lead us to ask ourselves the concept of internal representation of concepts and things that are not explicitly pointed out to the system, but that emerge through training.
Yeah.
And if we search for them, we may find and identify them, like it happened with the sentiment or with the continents. But there is no database, there is no list where you can see, okay, the system found another concept, and that is very interesting. We have to actively ask ourselves, does the system know about this? And then query the system, and then it will say, yeah, I actually know about it, including things that influence the performance of the system itself unexpectedly. Whenever GPT-4 was released, which is one of the leading large language models, since then we have been discovering surprising things about it and its performance and the way it behaves. Recently, I was very amused, but also kind of reacted in a negative way as well, when someone just discovered, because they tested it, that if you tip the large language model, promising...
If you tell the language model, you will tip them if they do the task.
That's right, because you cannot pay them yet.
Actually pay them.
I'm pretty sure we will get to that point, because, we can discuss why that is going to be the case. But today, you pretend that you will tip them, and they believe you. And believing you that you will tip them if they do a good job, they will do a better job than if you don't. Even more, people tested various values, and the large language model reacted to the amount of the tip being promised differently. And there were two peaks. One was at around $20 promised tip, and the other was several thousand dollars promised tip or something like that. Yeah. So how do you characterize the fact that we are still a year later discovering new features and new types of behaviors in these systems?
We're building the plane while we're flying. That's what's going on. By nature of the technology, we almost stumbled upon, because this technology is recent. It's like 15 years old at best. And it really became something out of a niche in 2012. Like, until 2012, I correct myself. The ideas for this technology are over 50 years old. The first ideas of neural nets, like, they back to the 50s. But until the early 2000s, we didn't know how to train them. And it's only really in 2012 that this became something that more than a dozen people in the world were interested in, right? And the big breakthrough has been not only like the architecture, like you mentioned, the transformer, but the fact that we have now so much data that we can train and compute, that we're sitting on, that we can train large and larger models, right? And the surprising but not so surprising fact is that these models, their capability doesn't grow linearly with the model size, but they're almost like jumps. It's as if once you reach a certain level of complexity, all of a sudden you unlock a whole set of capabilities that the previous generations of models were not able to achieve, right? And so why am I saying this? Because since it proceeds in jumps, which are not entirely predictable, you train a larger model and you know some of the capabilities you're training for, like you, for example, mentioned multimodality, you know, ability to understand data in various forms with the same model, images, text, and so on. And then you look for what's called capability overhang, meaning what else has the model unlocked? What else has the model learned to do that was not explicitly in the training goals, but somewhat got unlocked by the complexity level? And you do this in many ways. There are independent researchers who, like the paper you just mentioned, like, poke at the model and see, and think of them like model hackers, right? They are like trying to get the model to do things. And by now, every major research lab and company, they have the equivalent of bug bounty programs, right? So if you're a hacker, it's a standard like cybersecurity practice. If you're a hacker and you find unintended behavior, you report it to the company, and there is a responsible disclosure process. Whereas, you know, if the behavior is validated and it deemed harmful, you get a price. And so we handled these things similarly to cybersecurity risk, viruses and zero day bugs. The companies themselves have internal programs that primarily focus on, I would say, probably three axes. One is the thing we talked earlier, interpretability. So understanding better, opening the black box and understanding better what's going on. So being able to predict what these jumps in capability will be by having better theories about how the network works. Red teaming, which is what I do, meaning internally poking at the model very specifically in directions that we know to be harmful and then take measures to reduce that behavior. And automated, think the third one, you can think of it as the equivalent of test-driven development. You have a batch of tests through which the model has to go through in order to be deemed safe. And every new model that's released usually comes with a model card that says, hey, these are all the things that we've done. We used external researchers to test for these things. We've used internal tests to make sure that these capabilities are not present, and so on.
And you confirmed that regardless of the effort and the level of effort today, it is basically guaranteed that we have not exhaustively searched for everything the systems can do.
Yes, but at the same time, not every risk is the same, right? So if a model, you can think of the risk as a spectrum, and you want to assign probabilities to the different risks. And so if something can cause damage 10 and something can cause damage 100, you want to first make sure that the damage 100 is not present. And so typically the things that are discovered, like the bribing, it's annoying, it's an unexpected behavior, but it's not something that could potentially do lot of damage, meaning like where lives are at stake.
When a model is trained not to do something, mm-hmm. is the behavior deterministic or still probabilistic?
Yeah, great question. The models themselves are probabilistic in nature. So there is no way around the fact that the model is basically a very, very large mathematical function that has some randomness in it too. And so given an input, will give an output that has some level of randomness. That said, the techniques that we use and the techniques that are being discovered reduce the risky behavior below thresholds that are like deemed acceptable, like 0.01%. And I think, you know, we're moving towards a system where, if you think the nearest analogy I can think of in engineering are SLA levels. Like you have a contract with a service provider and you have a service level agreement that says, hey, our uptime is 99.999 whatever percent. And the more safety you want, the more assurance you want that the system is reliable, the more you'll pay for it. And I think there is some analogy to that, right?
So give me a couple of examples undesirable behavior that your activity as a member of a red team stops the system from exhibiting?
Yeah, well, most of the stuff I do, I cannot really talk about.
More in the abstract, if I want to give a simple example, it can be things that we deem socially or politically inappropriate.
Yeah.
Exhibiting racism, for example.
For sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you can think of undesirable thing, again, on a spectrum. There are undesirable things that are short-term and may impact society negatively. For example, like you said, bias, racism, toxic language, profiling certain racial groups. And so if the model is deployed in context of, say, hiring, for example, it would generate biased decisions. So that's something that all companies look at, and it's one of the axes that we try to mitigate. You could think of more longer term risks. For example, is the model exhibiting power seeking behavior? And so if you promise the model, instead of like dollars, what if you promise the model compute resources? Does the model show interest in acquiring those compute resources? This is not an immediate threat, but if you think of the future where models will be more powerful, it could be. So we want to keep that in check. You could also think, and that's what primarily what I do, and what you know other teams at other companies do. Can the model be used to harm people more explicitly? For example, I'll give you an example. If I'm a bad guy and I want to do harm, let's say I want to plan a terrorist attack, will using a GPT-4 equivalent model help me more than using Google in doing my in planning or in achieving my goal? We make extremely sure that the answer is no. You will be no better position using an AI model than you would be if you were using a search engine. There are questions around autonomy, like these models are more and more being tasked with autonomous decisions, and some of these could be harmful. So you want to build a system, a harness around them, such that they cannot create damage. And these are some examples of what you look for, what we look for.
How do you structure a red teaming effort in the situation and condition that you described of a potential quantum leap in the capability overhang in the forthcoming systems? Mm-hmm. How do you expect to be able to test rapidly enough? For example, you mentioned that the system shouldn't be power seeking. Mm-hmm. And I would guess, since this is a classic example of AI nightmares, the genie out of the bottle in the hands of a not very smart user that is asking it to do something in good faith. So the order received by the system is not by itself seeking to do harm, but the second order consequences of that request are harmful to whatever degree you want to imagine. So the system is not seeking power for itself. It is seeking power in order to deliver on what it has been built for, which is to support the user, right?
Paperclip scenario in a way.
The classic example is that. Even though I don't find it very useful because the original request is kind of silly. We should come up, in my opinion, with examples that are more where the person listening to that example can imagine, oh, I could actually see myself asking the engine something like, yes, right? So the unexpected features and characteristics, coupled with the quantum leaps that they can exhibit, the competitive pressure that every provider of these systems is under to deliver on the financial returns that they promised to their investors, are setting up a scenario where it is very difficult to say, for example, for someone like you internally, listen, guys, I really need 6 months more, but maybe 6 years, or maybe 600 years until I am in a position where I can tell you I did everything that is reasonably possible to do, and the probability that this will cause harm is now very, very far removed, so that I can tell you, yes, let's go and release it.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And this is addressed differently by different companies. So I can talk about how we at Anthropic address it, and how we hope this becomes the kind of example for other companies to follow, and other companies are following. We have a thing called the responsible scaling policy, which is a document, and you can provide the link, which is a document that Anthropic released in September last year, that outlines how we think about exactly this problem. And it's an interesting document coming from a company, because in that policy, there are commitments that in the worst case scenario are detrimental to the company's business. So the company is committing to defining, as you can show here, safety levels. And basically, before you release a model at a certain level, one of the commitments is that the next level is going to be well-defined. And so one of the commitments is we will not release a model that is exhibiting features of what we call, say, ASL 3, AI safety level 3, before the ASL 4 level is well-defined. And also, there are commitments around the kind of things that we worry about at each level and the kind of actions we will take to remediate the potential risks. And you can read it in detail, but this is a it's a pivotal moment, because it tries to rein in the inherent conflict that you outlined so well between, you know, corporate interests and competitive pressure on the one hand, and safety and doing the right thing on the other. And in this document, it says, like, hey, we could decide to pause indefinitely or even shut down if we see that certain capabilities that are risky cannot be mitigated, and it's not safe to proceed. And so a company committing to that is very powerful, I think. And it needs to it needs to be reflected also in the company structure, because what we've seen in, with what happened with the OpenAI drama, I know very little about the internals. I actually know nothing about the internals, but seeing from the outside, like everyone, it seemed that there was a conflict between the two sides, the corporate side and the ethics side, and somehow they could not resolve it. And this, the fail-safe mechanisms that they had put in place did not work, because the board removed the CEO, and then the CEO came back and removed the board, and basically now has more freedom to do whatever whatever he was doing before. I don't know the specifics, and so I don't want to speculate.
And let me give you another example where in a lot of movies we see the complexity of governance structures, not only in private companies, but over the scale, for example, of the United States of America government. A wonderful movie is The 3 Days of the Condor, talking about the CIA and how within the intelligence community, there are different factions that are either just competing for resources or, as in the movie, are literally at war with each other. And already there are situations where the needs and abilities of certain advanced corporations are sought after by the government for its own objectives, and certain corporations are able to resist and others are not able to resist. End-to-end encryption is an example where there is a constant pressure by the government to weaken end-to-end encryption. Companies like Apple have been able, supposedly, to resist. But even that supposedly is interesting, because there are now legal tools available to the government that prohibit, under the threat of potentially lifelong imprisonment, to even talk about the fact that you have been requested to weaken your protections. So when you talk about governance, I think it is important to look at it in an even broader context, not only in the context of a single company, not only in the context of a set of companies, but also in relationship to one or more governments who could have the power to say, oh, you don't want to release it commercially? I agree, but give it to us and we will, you know,
take care of it. Yeah.
And if you say, I don't want to give it to you, well, they force you to give it to them.
Yeah. It's a very complex world, and it becomes even more complex when it becomes at the international level, because you have competing pressure. Not every country is on the same terms with every other country. And for example, the relationships between US and China are complex, and AI is definitely a topic on which there is friction, because of the capabilities AI can offer.
I am smiling because the fact that AI cannot be regulated, otherwise China wins, has been a constant argument by the by those participants in the USAI community who want completely unfettered and unregulated opportunities to develop. However, China put in place like
a very strong regulation,
a 1,000 pages regulation where they clearly define that you must subject the development, the test, and the deployment of these tools to all kinds of controls. And if not, we know they don't hesitate to enforce.
Shut it down, to enforce
the regulations to the extreme. There are no excuses, no delays.
I think the US government is trying to find their way in this, and the executive order that came out in October is an example of them looking for a way to like the US way of navigating this conundrum of like, how do we make sure these things are safe but also benefit from the potential of this technology.
What do you think of those who are afraid that the regulation is too early? Mm-hmm. That, as it is often the case, the risk of giving up the benefits of the technology are higher than not reducing the potential harm that it can create. Europe is putting in place all kinds of explicit prohibitions already. Not only about the capabilities, but specific applications of the technology that will be outlawed. And there are those who say, no, we must accelerate open source decentralized AI as powerful as our tools allow, because we don't want to just have a handful of people deciding what can or cannot be done, what should or shouldn't be done. They don't know better. And you know, I haven't met the founder of Anthropic. I haven't met the founder of
OpenAI
or the president of the United States. But I can tell you that they are not infallible.
Of course.
Right?
Yeah.
So what do you think about the argument that the people who are in favor of decentralized open source approaches that unavoidably then escape these control mechanisms?
Yeah, I've been a long time supporter of open source in software, and I think open source is amazing on a number of ways. I find myself a bit more on the fence in open source in AI because of this capability overhang that we were discussing, and because a large model has potential to do dangerous things, or to do negative things, even without going into the dangers, to do negative things, and if left unchecked, could be dangerous. I think that the argument of hey, this is just tactics for regulatory capture, and you know, it's basically a corporate ploy to protect the few big companies. I don't think that's true. I think companies are trying to do their best in developing a safe technology because it's in their interest in the first place. Like, if for a company to be successful, you need to have a product that is useful, but it's also safe. So we're definitely navigating novel territory. Humanity has never been confronted with the development of a technology that has these capabilities. And so we're learning what's the best way. One thing I want to say, though, with your initial question was like, people say it's too early to regulate. And what I want to say about that is, and you taught me that actually, exponential technologies are hard, very hard to predict, very hard to form an intuition around. And you always end up, or very often end up, underestimating the jump or the potential impact that a thing on an exponential trend will have few years later, because we evolved in a linear world, and we evolved in a world where we're used to thinking that the future will be equal to the past. So given that, it's never too early to think about things, because even a small delta today, a small difference today in capability will be amplified by the exponential trend. So I don't think it's early at all.
And the example that I give, actually developing a new terminology for specifically talking about these trends in artificial intelligence is what I call the jolting dynamics, mm-hmm. where we are not only looking at in a logarithmic chart, drawing a straight line, which is what represents an exponential. But as Jepsen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA, showed just less than a year ago in their worldwide conference, they are looking at a double or even
a double triple
yeah. exponential, because instead of increasing the power of their systems by something like a thousandfold over 20 years, which would have been predicted by the exponential growth of Moore's Law or something like that, they are now expecting to have increased it 10 million fold.
And that
underscores what you said about how hard it is to almost biologically understand what is going on. We are not compatible with the dynamic of these systems. So taking that into account, how paranoid someone that is in your role should be, and is it dangerous to your mental health?
So someone in my role should be very paranoid, because that's my job. I'm paid to be paranoid, and I'm paid to be paranoid so that other people don't have to be paranoid about it. So I think companies and people working in doing research in this field should be absolutely paranoid. Paranoid about real things. So I'm not worried about GPT-4, you know, taking over, Even closer thing, I'm not worried about GPT-4 finding the solution to nanotechnology and turning us into Grey Goo. That's not going to happen. We're not at that level of AI, and we won't be for a while. But GPT-4 can be used, for example, for misinformation. You can be a player that has the intention to create certain narratives and spread certain narratives, and you can leverage technology like GPT-4 or like generative models in general to scale out those narratives. And so being paranoid about these consequences and working to mitigate them is what I do.
Let me give you an example. I am planning to improve my pattern recognition using AI tools in order to push it as far as possible, discovering surprising, unexpected, apparently non-logical correlations while stopping before it becomes a superstition or something that is harmful to me or to others. And I am actively looking to find things that are being reported, in the scientific literature or even in economics, that can be early warnings of these systems being used in this way that I am describing in order to gain some advantage that without the use of those systems wouldn't be possible.
What have you found so far?
Well, one thing that I haven't executed on fully yet, but I am starting to collect data about, is the effect that COVID collectively had on humanity. For example, I can tell you that cognitively, to me, it is a little bit of a black hole. If I ask myself, what did I do over those 2 years? I have a hard time even remembering.
Interesting.
And psychologically, it is almost like covered in a fog, right? Fred Hoyle, who was a wonderful astronomer, but also a very good science fiction author, wrote a book, I don't remember the title now, where a British spy goes to Ireland, where the economy is booming and very strange construction is going on and all kinds of things. Spoiler alert, it's the aliens. The spy actually finds out, and then he's able to meet the aliens at the end of the book. And they are hiding. They don't want to show themselves, but they had that kind of effect on the economy of Ireland. And the book was written in the 50s, I think. So the fact that this could be hidden was easier, given that the world wasn't so interconnected. But those are the kinds of things that we can, I think, watch for. And the example that I gave of NVIDIA is, I think, a good example. Jepsen Huang is explicit about the fact that they are using AI to build the chips
that will power the next generation of AI.
And they couldn't do without, they couldn't achieve the kind of jolting change that they achieve if they didn't have this kind of approach. So how...
And let me mention a thing here. In the context of AI safety, we will increasingly rely on AI to fight AI.
Yeah.
Because it won't be possible otherwise, or to check and test, right?
So how likely is that the next version, or the version after the next, let's call it GPT-5 and GPT-6, just for the sake of
simplicity.
Mm-hmm. We could call it Claude 3, Claude 4, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
How dismissive would you be if someone came and asked, can you trust your ability to test those systems, or could they be hiding their abilities purposefully from you so that those capabilities that are undesirable in your view, but desirable from their point of view, can be kept?
I'm smiling because you keep asking me questions about things that are being researched right now at Anthropic, and so I just gave you another link to our most recent article. There is research on how these systems can be deceptive, and we're actively trying to characterize how they can be deceptive and what to do about it. This is an interesting paper because it shows that you can train a deceptive model that will persist in its nefarious or like hidden goals even through current safety training procedures. And you can see, like, obviously this is a toy example because no one is training an agent to be deceptive purposefully, but it shows a gap in our current safety training because it shows the current safety training would not be effective if the model had been trained with a hidden goal, which is not the case currently, but in the future, GPT, like you said, GPTN could have goals of its own. And so we want to make sure that they are aligned with safety.
These kinds of results are important because they show boundary conditions of our current knowledge, but potentially they also show the kind of results that Gödel's incompleteness theorem represents in mathematics. Things that are not necessarily resolvable within a given system. And I don't know if you are familiar with the work of Roman Jampolsky, who is an AI safety and security researcher.
Very nice chat.
He is at the University of Louisville. And recently he published a book that is all about the kinds of research that points in this direction of how systems are uncontrollable, unexplainable, and at least according to his results, they will stay that way. We don't have today a provably reliable way of securing these systems.
Yeah, I haven't read this his most recent book, so I'd be very curious to read it and comment after I've read it.
Yeah, I will be at the Beneficial AGI conference in Panama City in less than a month. Roman is going to be there as well, and other people in the field. So I will have the opportunity to talk to him too.
I wanted to, before I lose it, you mentioned Fred Hoyle. I haven't read that book you mentioned, but there's another book by Fred Hoyle, which I've read, that's super interesting. It's called The Black Cloud. I don't know if you've read it.
Yes, I read it.
Yes. I think it's very interesting on a number of aspects, but it shows to me, it's like, what could a future version of intelligence be like? Not next year, not in 10 years, but more like in a few centuries. I think it's an interesting book. Just wanted to mention it.
Thank you. And favorite way of describing an uploaded mind is actually a swarm of nanoprobes accelerated to a speed close to the speed of light through laser beams by the billions.
Yep.
Which have no individual capabilities of navigation and very, very limited capabilities of computation and communication, but these billions of probes together represent a mind, and it just goes on exploring the universe.
Yeah, let's not spoil the book for the audience. There is some analogy to what you said, yes, the mind doesn't need to be inside a skull.
So for those who are not every day involved in this field, what do you recommend? What are the best ways that they can keep themselves informed on what is happening at the leading edges of this kind of AI safety research?
Yes, very good question. So there are a number of AI conversation happens on Twitter. That's on X now. It's where all leading researchers discuss everything. So even just following a few folks on X gives a view into what's happening. There is a couple of newsletters I wanted to mention. One is Import AI by Jack Clark. Disclaimer, I work with Jack, I obviously respect him a lot, but his newsletter I had been following for years, way before we worked together, and it's a very good condensation of what's going on in AI. If one is interested more in the commercial sides, there is a site called Ben's Bytes, which I will also share here. Ben's Bytes is looking more at like what are new startups, what are, how is this technology actually being used in practice. So Jack's newsletter, Import AI, is more around the research. Ben's Bytes is more around the startup and commercial. And the third one I want to recommend is Deep Learning AI, which I'll also share here, which is Andrew Ng's newsletter. The second link you have there. Yeah, that one. The interesting thing about Deep Learning AI is it always tries to explain why something is important. So not only tells you like, hey, this is a relevant result that happened recently, but also this is why you should care about it, or these are the implications about it. There are a number of weirder folks I follow on Twitter that have weirder publications, and I'm still like gauging whether I trust what they say or not, so I don't feel like recommending. The three I recommended are like pretty solid sources of information that I rely on the bio.
Now, obviously, I didn't insist when you said that you cannot talk about X, Y, or Z today. But do you expect that you will be also publishing something in a given amount of time about your work?
We have a few publications out, and we will have more in the future. So, yes, absolutely.
Well,
at least in the form of like high-level blog posts, for sure. Probably also some more scientific papers.
Wonderful. So thank you very much for being with us today. What you're doing is very important, existentially so.
I hope so.
And more people should be paying attention to it, as well as more companies should realize how important this work is, both for those who are directly designing and deploying these advanced systems, but in general, the next years and decades of the 21st century will be deeply influenced and potentially defined by what we get right or wrong about the next generation advanced AI systems.
Yes, and if I may, I want to say something. We are in a different era with respect to even like 5 years ago, where AI safety was relegated to a few researchers in universities. Every major company is scrambling to build teams that look into these things. We were one of the first, but every other lab follows suit. And you know, there is OpenAI preparedness team. There is Google DeepMind has their own effort in safety. So if you're interested in this, look at open roles. Every major company is hiring in this area of AI safety, and it's, in my opinion, the most important thing one can be doing now. So if anyone is looking for their new thing, there is plenty of work to be done.
Wonderful. Francesco, thank you again, and I hope to have you back to talk about what has happened in the meantime. But good luck, and good luck to you and to all of us for the work that you are doing.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure, and see you next time.
Thank you very much for being here today at Searching for the Question Live. I hope that you enjoyed this conversation. Lately, I have been transcribing and editing and publishing the conversations more diligently, because with the use of AI tools, what was an effort I could just not handle became absolutely doable and even enjoyable. So please look at my newsletter or blog or every platform where I post the links to catch an edited transcript of our conversation with Francesco, as well as the links that we have shared during the conversation today. Thank you very much, and see you next time.